nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
I'm going to talk about phase field modeling at mesoscale to simulate plastic deformation and to simulate fracture. Okay, so I'll see if I have time to do both. So I'm going to go fast over the two things and see if I make it on time. So plastic deformation, I have this slide just in case you're not familiar, right? So you have a stress strain curve, you have the elastic regime, and then you have the plastic regime, right? So it's not linear anymore. And the important thing is that when you start unloading, it doesn't go back to the same point, but you have some remnant deformation, so some plastic deformation. So if you look at the definition of plastic deformation or the yield stress, which is the stress at which this plastic deformation starts, it says that it's a material property, but actually, if you go into the microstructure, the yield stress that is shown here is very small. The font is very small. So the yield stress as a function of the grain size, for example, is not constant. So if you have a different microstructure, this point where plasticity starts depends on the average grain size and other details, but roughly on average grain size. This is another slide to show again plastic deformation. So if you have a single crystal, this is nickel. And this is very small, and I like these pictures because you can see plastic activity in slip planes, right? So this is an FCC material. They come here with an indenter, they put pressure here, and they deform this cylinder made of nickel. And you see that the deformation is not continuous, but happens in discrete planes. And what is interesting is also that the deformation doesn't happen in a smooth way, but it's like in avalanches. And this is another picture, more or less the same, and you see one slip plane, other slip planes getting active as you deform the material. The thing is, when you go to larger scales and you have a polycrystal, you see all these in average, and it looks more continuous. So how we represent this plastic deformation? So if you go to continuum models, what they are going to do is, so you have an elastic deformation and then you have regions where you have plastic deformation. So if you go to atomistics, what you have are atoms missing in one layer, right, or in one line here, and those are dislocations that are the ones that drive this plastic deformation. Another approach is what is called discrete dislocation dynamics. So instead of dealing with individual atoms, you deal directly with the dislocation lines and you build the stress and strain fields of each one of these defects, these dislocations, and you use a continuum description to move these lines. So what we do is, in between discrete and continuum, so what we do is we look at this slip plane where the deformation happens and we discretize these planes, and then in this slip surface, we have contours that are phase fields, these phase fields, and these phase fields track the deformation or the slip on each one of these planes. So for an FCC material, you're going to have 12. If you have other kind of crystals, you may have, like we deal also with some molecular crystals, and in molecular crystals, you have two or three only of these planes.
Can you explain that equation a little
bit? Okay, yeah, so what this equation, so this is the slip in one of these planes. Okay? So if you have a slip, and if we go to the real picture, like here, so this is the slip in each one of these planes. Okay? How much one plane slips with respect to the other one.
Lined up with the crystal structure of the plane there.
Exactly. So this plane here is one of those. Right? And then how much one plane slips with respect to each other is our phase field. So our phase field tells you how much one of these planes slip with respect to each other. You have many of those, right? So in some representation, you may have this slip plane and this and then this. So you have to move all at the same time.
Why is it called phase field?
Because we have, I think it's history. And it's because the original name for this comes from phase transformations. And every time you have a field describing a quantity, they call it phase field, because it comes from phase transformation literature, I guess. So, let's see if I have, it's coming layer, so I'll go over this layer. So this is to...
So before you go on quickly, the units there are also distances?
The units of the phase field, it's a slip, so it's a distance, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we write everything in terms of a Barger's vector, and the Barger's vector is this distance, from here to here, okay? So this is to show that this yield stress, as I said before, depends on the grain size. So you have here some, this is a combination of plots for copper, for nanocrystalline copper. So these red lines are the average grain size at which these experiments were done. And what you see is that the yield stress is larger as you decrease the grain size. And that has to do with the, it's called hole pitch, and it has to do with the room that dislocations, this slip has to, or these dislocations have to move, right? Because if your grains are very small, these dislocations trying to move, but they can't because they find grain boundaries and they get stuck there. But then, so when you increase the grain size, the yield stress is going to go smaller, get smaller and smaller. And then at some point, you see, again, in some materials, you see that the yield stress starts getting smaller again. And what happens is that you have grain boundaries, and you have so many grain boundaries that now the plastic deformation doesn't happen because of dislocation, but happens because of grains sliding with respect to each other.
And just distributing the forces through several mechanisms rather than being at one point.
Exactly. Yeah, so in one case, so you have two mechanisms for plasticity. One is dislocations moving, and the other mechanism is grain sliding with respect to each other. If your grains are very large, they cannot slide much, or even if they slide, this deformation is very small compared to the volume. Okay? So when you have grain sizes that are large, the grain boundary sliding is not very important in overall, because you have very, very few grain boundaries, because your grains are big. So when you have small grains, a lot of deformation happens in the grain boundaries. And it does this. But sometimes, so this is what is called hole pitch, and this is what is called inverse hole pitch. And sometimes you don't have inverse hole pitch, and this has to do with grain boundaries that are very strong. And so the grains cannot slide with respect to each other. Okay?
That's more a special case.
Huh?
Is that more of a special case?
No? At the beginning, they have, when they published this paper, they have all this, and there was this kind of disagreement, right? So in some cases you do, in some cases you don't. You don't know why. But when you do simulations, those are our simulations, and what we did is we tried to do similar structures. Ours are smaller than those. But what you do is you change the energetics of the grain boundary, right? And you say you let it slide or you don't. And that's what this energy means, right? No grain boundary sliding means like an infinite grain boundary cohesive energy. And you don't have any, so you have hole pitch all the time because it gets smaller and the only mechanism are the dislocations and they cannot move because they move a little bit and they see a grain boundary. So the yield stress becomes very, very large. But when you start letting the grains slide, you go to the other regime and one grain slides with respect to each other and then you can decrease the yield stress. So you can engineer the grain boundary so not only with the size but also with the energetics of the grain boundary, you can get different yield stresses.
Very basic question.
Yeah.
Are you talking about these polycrystalline materials?
Mm-hmm.
Just the crystals, or are they embedded in a matrix?
No, it's just grain against grain.
Just
yeah.
100%. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No matrix in here.
Why is the scaling of d to the minus 1?
Because the formula that all the engineers use is this. The yield stress is a function of 1 over the square root of the grain size, which is the hole pitch relationship. But if you go to smaller grains, you're going to have something different. And actually what we see is that this rule is not valid all the time because also depends on the energy of your grains. So sometimes...
but for hole pitch,
For very large grains, that works.
Yeah.
Not for inverse. So at these small scales,
it doesn't work.
That's from the 50s, the whole batch. And it's super important.
1912. The bit, I think it's, isn't it? Okay, then record that. I don't know. I have to check, but I think
it's. But this is what in materials field, my department, they do this all the time, right? You change the grain size with heat treatment, and you make things harder or softer and more plastic or less.
Yeah, and you can see here that at larger grain sizes, most of the experiments follow this, right? The problem is when you go to smaller grain sizes that you start seeing different behaviors. Right, but at larger grain sizes, this one over square root comes from these locations only, and that's more or less understood.
If you change the size, the mechanism can differ. You get two different things. Well, two or arguably three different things going on. Yeah.
So here what we try to explain is this disagreement. Like sometimes you have inverse, sometimes you don't have. So we were trying to see why one or the other.
50, 51, 50.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it's, so those are, this is again kind of Hall patch effect for those, here is a single crystal. So it's not that you have a matrix, all the grains together. You have only one grain. And they also show size effect. So those are experiments done in the Air Force in 2004. So as you make this cylinder, the radius of the cylinder is smaller and smaller, the yield stress gets higher and higher. Okay? And in this case, there is no inverse because you don't have any grain boundary. But the interesting thing is that the way they explain this is that as you make the cylinder smaller, you have fewer dislocations, right? And then you cannot, then your yield stress is going to be higher because you don't have dislocations, basically. I think I'm going to skip this. And I'm going to skip this. So let me go about the phase field, how we represent the phase field. And I guess this may explain a little more your question. So you imagine this is one slip plane, okay? And this is the phase field is equal to one here and it's zero here. What that means is that this region is lit by one Burgess vector. The plane below and the plane above, they are moved with one Burgess vector. Then what you can do is you identify the contours of these slip regions as dislocations. So that's what we do in our simulations. Then we have different terms in the phase field. And again, this let's take it easy here because there are too many equations. But, so then what we do is we evolve each of the phase fields on each of the slip planes. So we have three phase fields for each slip plane. And it's evolved using a Ginzburg-Landau equation, that minimizes the energy, basically. So we have 12 of these equations, and the energy depends on the 12 phase fields, and we solve all these simultaneously. So this energy has one term, which is the interaction between these locations, which is an elastic term. Then we have a misfit term that takes into account details of the atomistic structure. And the last term is an external driving force that can be an applied strain or an applied stress. So what we do is we write this internal energy in Fourier space because it makes things easier to deal with. And we use a FFT algorithm to evaluate the internal energy. The other two are evaluating real space. So we evolve these 12 phase, these 12 fields with this energy here that depends on the 12 fields. This, don't worry, is all the mathematical part, but it's basically dislocation, dislocation interaction, atomistic details, driving force. Okay?
Okay,
let me tell you about this. We have a picture here. So this phase field, for example, you have a, these are atoms, right? We don't deal with atoms, but it's easier to explain with atoms. So this location is where you have an atom missing. And the plastic deformation occurs when this location, which is this defect, you have an atom missing there, starts sliding because you applied a stress field. Okay? Here, what you see are these planes. This plane is oriented like this in this cylinder. And the displacement of this plane with respect to the one below is this phase field. So how much one plane is displaced with respect to the other one is this. Okay?
So just to treat them, the first one is a continuum kind of thing because mm-hmm. it's related to dislocations and how they interact. The second one you said is atomistic because it's the boundary.
It's coming. So
what
it's
is the third one?
The third one is the driving force. The stress that you apply. So you have a sample and you apply the stress or you apply the strain. Okay? So it's just the driving force for the whole energetics. So the atomistic details are here. And so, for example, this is work we did with Ale and people in Los Alamos too. So what you do is you graph, you do a molecular dynamic simulations and you put all the atoms in there, right? And then you try to slide this sample that is there in several directions. Okay. And then you look at the energy that the atoms feel because these atoms have to jump over other ones, right, to start moving. So the energy landscape that these atoms see moving, for example, in the 112 direction or in the 110 direction looks like this. Okay? So you have minimum here and you have maximum here. Okay? So that tells you in what directions they want to move. Okay? So we put this energy landscape into our misfit energy and that will tell you where the sleep, I mean, in which directions you want to sleep one plane with respect to the other plane. Okay? So we don't deal with the atoms, but we deal with some of these details.
It is a little strange because the steel are bound. So it's not like two surfaces moving on top of each other. You have new chemical bonds forming and so on. Everything is taken into account.
They do that. We don't. So we take only the energy landscape. So what you feel when you try to slide, the energy that you have to put when you try to slide in this direction or in this or in the other directions.
That energy is exactly that. It's the energy to break bonds and to then they reform. So this is perfectly reversible. We were talking about this before in the context of this healing materials. We have plastic deformation belts. We do this all the time. And of course, there's nothing in between. So the planes of atoms do this. And every atom goes back to perfect, ideal positions, and it's just as good as new after the dislocation passed because it moved. That's why there's a lot of constraints about which crystals, directions, and what's the Burgers factor because it's a periodic repeated unit of the crystal.
So this formula that is there on the bottom is how, and you don't have to read it, is how we include this surface into our model, really in terms of these displacements. Okay? As you see here, this is a one cut in different directions, right? So this is in the 112 direction, so this is in this direction, and the atoms see this energy landscape. So they have to go from here, jump all the way to here. If you want to move from this direction to this direction, the atoms have to go all the way like that. Okay? So atoms, of course, prefer to do this, go in this direction. So we include these are results that at the beginning when we include this misfit energy into our solutions, and then what happens is that instead of having only these locations, you create other defects that are these green, yellow things here, which are called stacking fold energies. And let me tell you what these stacking fold energies are. So these are simulations for nickel and aluminum. So you nucleate a dislocation in the grain boundary. These blue dots are grain boundaries. You nucleate the dislocation. Dislocation starts moving. And this dislocation leaves behind a defect, which is called a stacking fold. Okay? Because you have a plane and another plane, right? So if you move perfectly and you have a sequence, let's say ABC, right? So if you have a sequence ABC, you move and you don't break the sequence. You keep that one. But if they move in another direction, you may break the sequence. So then you have a stacking fold, which is this yellow region. Some materials have larger stacking fold energy, like, for example, here, this is, you have aluminum and nickel, and aluminum has a larger stacking fault energy, so it doesn't like to create stacking fault areas like these ones. So they are very, thank you. They are very,
they compensate for being.
This is very small. Nickel, the stacking fault energy is lower, so it doesn't mind creating these large stacking faults. Okay, so you create, what our code can do is create these dislocations and track the motion of these dislocations and also these defects that tell you what kind of dislocations you have.
What is the difference between nickel and aluminum? This is the crystal structure or bonding energy? Why the stacking fault energy
It's the same crystal structure, just the bonding.
Yeah, it's just the bonding, yeah.
So
they are both FCC. The only difference is...
But I mean, the figures look different. You know.
Yeah, what you see is, yeah, the dislocation doesn't... The dislocation structure doesn't depend only on the crystalline structure, but depends on other characteristics like this stacking fault energy.
So this is FCC is this closed pack packing like oranges. It's A B C A B C. And HCP, that's another crystal structure. It's A B A B A B. Mm-hmm. And the energy difference between those two has to do with the electrons. With some atoms don't mind the difference. The bonding is very close. All of them have 12 years neighbors. But the coordinations, the angles are slightly different. So some of them, it's similar to singlet and worksite. You know, some compound semiconductors prefer singlet, others prefer worksite. This is similar. Now, how much they dislike one or the other?
But maybe I don't understand the shape of this figure. What this graph shows?
This is a green. Let's see if I have another one here that explains, shows this better. All these blue lines, this is the sample that is here. And we cut one plane to look in 2D, because if we look in 3D, it's messy and it's hard to follow. So you cut here, and what you have, the blue dots are grain boundaries. Okay? And the green lines are dislocations. So you start with a, in our case, we start with a crystal that has dislocations only in the grain boundaries, and the dislocations start nucleating and propagating. So when you deform aluminum, you do not generate large stacking faults because it's very expensive energetically to create those stacking faults. When you deform a nickel, you create dislocations and also stacking faults because for the for nickel it's not that energetically that expensive. Okay?
The atomistic picture that earlier maybe shows what it means to have the trailing and the because it's hard, these are hard things to, no, the one that had all the atoms on the side.
This.
That one. Yeah.
No. So but imagine, these are the atoms and the stacking sequence. Okay? So you have the A and B. Right? The blue and the orange. And then you can slide this atom to this position. Right? So you go from this B to this B. But when you try to do that, the crystal structure doesn't want to do that because it's, instead of going, so if you go from here to here, you have to go this way. So what they want to do is they want to go here and then there. Okay? So instead of moving, they move just in this direction. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't have to.
Basically, you have to do a whole periodic sliding of the crystal. But in FCC, it's easier to do it in two little steps. So the first step takes you halfway in a direction, at an angle. And then the second one finishes. And so they have this, they're called partial dislocation. So the first slip doesn't recover the crystal perfectly. It leaves this defect that's called a stacking fault. That doesn't cost a lot of energy because the atoms they still have 12 neighbors and whatnot. But you don't want to do that forever because that, you know, the more you do it, the more energy it costs. So then there's another partial that basically finishes the step. You do it instead of doing one step, you do it in two little steps.
Mm-hmm.
When you combine the two.
Yeah.
So that's why those pictures, the white is perfect crystal, the ones that Ali was asking about, where you had the aluminum and nickel.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The white is perfect crystal. And the yellow is this defect that's in between where you do it in two steps.
So here you have the two partials together, so the crystal that you leave behind is perfect. Here they are far away, so you have a defect in between the two dislocations.
Yeah, perhaps
that. Exactly. In aluminum, they don't like to have these half steps, so they always, you get the first and the second one together.
But you say they both have the same crystal structure?
Yes.
No.
They are both FCC.
They're both FCC.
But one doesn't really like the HCP at all, and so it costs a lot of energy to this half step, right, leaves a defect behind, because it's not a full step. And if that defect costs a lot of energy, you don't do it.
Okay, so, but also what we see is that if you change, this is all nickel now, but if you have a small grain size, in this case the average grain size is 10 nanometers, and you have this, again, the blue dots are grain boundaries, so you have those, and then you have a larger grain size, larger and even larger. So the area of the stacking fold, it doesn't depend only on the energetics, but also depends on the grain size. So when you have small grain size, even though the crystal doesn't want to have a stacking fold, doesn't have room to nucleate the other dislocation that will close the stacking fold.
Does that have anything to do with, so let's make up numbers. Say you have a small grain size, and say you've got, simplified things, but like 40 nickel dimples. Then you go to a bigger size grain. Now let's say maybe 100 nickel dimples or aluminum. So then the bigger grain, so there's more bonds. Great.
I don't think it has to do with the bonds. It has with the has to do with the room you have to nucleate, because you have one dislocation and then you have another dislocation, right? If you don't have enough room to have the two dislocations in the grain, you leave a stacking fold behind. It's,
so
it has to do
with total energy required to move it.
No, because it has to do with the density. But then you have the sample size is the same in all of them, right? The only difference is that you this dislocation cannot go across a grain boundary sometimes.
So that's, I guess, was also my question, is that whenever you have perfect things, it looks like you have to do changes on bigger chunks. That intuition is not correct?
I don't think so. I think it has to do with...
That's sort of analogous.
Yeah, so imagine you nucleate this dislocation here. So these two dislocations repel each other, right? Because they have the same size, so they don't like to be together. So you have these two constraints. The dislocations don't want to be together, but then if they are far apart, you have a defect, right? So you have to pay, it's a balance between the two. If you don't have room to nucleate, because the dislocations are nucleating the grain boundary. So imagine you nucleate this one. If the second one doesn't have room to be nucleated because it's, the other one is still there, you cannot nucleate the second one. And you will see later on that this is not only a function of the grain size, but also of the strain rate. So if you have very high strain rates, you cannot nucleate the second one that will get rid of this defect. Now let me go to strain rates. So now what we are doing are the same simulations, and those are stress, strain. And this is a very high strain rate. Blue is, so you see 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7. So as you decrease the strain rate, the flow, the yield stress decreases, which is something that is very well known. And another thing that you see is that for very high strain rate, the curves are smooth. And for low strain rates, you have this red deformation there. Strain rate is 1/2. This is not strain rate. This is strain. So the strain doesn't have units, and
no,
the stress.
But you said like 10^8 per second.
Per second.
So I'm trying to understand what is that
actually. Is how fast I deform some. So the strain is. I change the length of something. So it's the change in length divided by the original length, basically, right? And then how fast you do that deformation is the strain rate. So if I do it very slow or if I go boom.
You're saying 100% change every nanosecond. Okay. Okay. I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's right.
It's very high. So experiments usually are in the 10 to the minus 4.
But in a shock, you would have those.
Yes, yeah. So, but in, yeah, but in like an experiment, like a mechanical experiment, you will have a strain rate 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the 0, 10 to the 1 at most.
Right, so this is not like a very long distribution.
It is, but...
No, it's less so than
The problem I have is that in my simulations, it's very hard for me to go to slower strain rates because my dimensions are very small. So I'm resolving nanometer scales, so my strain rates are going to be high just because the grid is very small.
Well, but you don't have to in these simulations.
In these simulations. We can go in other ones. So if I don't want to resolve the individual dislocations and so on, I can go to smaller strain rates because my grid size can go larger. So that we can do both things. But in this case, we are there. And so here what we see is 15 nanometer grain size and 2 strain rates.
Even these are fast, these are orders of magnitude slower than MD. So MD we can do 10 to the 8. That's a heroic calculation. So this takes it several GUID, basically atomic level resolution in terms of space, takes it a few orders of magnitude slower than what we can do with MD because we have to resolve atomic vibrations.
So that here looks like you don't have activity, but is that the stacking fault disappeared, but you still have perfect dislocations and we are tracking only stacking faults. When you go to higher strain rates, is instead of, so I don't know if you saw the other one, but you nucleate only 2 and these slip over the whole system. When you go to higher strain rates, you start having nucleations everywhere of these locations and they start moving. So it's a very different picture. So in slow strain rates, you have only 1 that advances over the whole system. High strain rates, you have nucleations everywhere. And you see that better.
Explain it how you see it developing the 1 and the 2.
So this is a slow strain rate case. Yeah. Okay. And as you start deforming, so imagine you have this cube and you start applying.
This is the fast one.
You know what? The other two, this is this, these two, there is a typo here. This should be 2^6 and this 2^8.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So these are the right ones. I'll fix it later. So you have these two nucleations. Actually, it's the same one because you have periodic boundary conditions and they start advancing and moving, right? As you apply more and more strain. But it's basically one source that nucleates this defect and the defect starts propagating everywhere. In the other case, the high strain rate, which is 10 to the 8, you have nothing and suddenly you have activity everywhere. And then this activity keeps going everywhere as you apply more and
so
more strain.
If I apply a sort of intuitive feel to this, would that mean that at lower strain, well, at high strain rates, it's like a shock and just a whole bunch of things happen at once without really communicating with each other, whereas at slower, things can concentrate and build and you'll just have a smaller number of events, smaller number of larger events as
opposed exactly.
to a higher number of smaller events.
Exactly. So now if we look at the areas split by these partial dislocations, as a function of the strain, what we have at different strain rates is that, as we say, high strain rates all starts together very suddenly here, right? So this is all these events being nucleated. This is like the sum of all these events being nucleated. When you go to slower strain rates, it's more progressive, right? So you have one that starts propagating very slowly over the whole sample. But also it's interesting that the onset of these nucleation events is delay when you have higher strain rates. Okay, and this is also observed in molecular dynamics simulations. So if we, what we did is try to move. So what we did is we move all these curves together, so they all start at the same value, and that's what's coming in the next picture. So we are trying to see some criticality or something like to make connections with these critical phenomena. So if I move all these to here together, right, so to the zero, what I call critical strain is when this starts nucleating, right? So, and this critical strain depends on the strain rate. So if I move all these curves together, what I have is that they all overlap each other at the beginning, okay? And the area of the partial, of the defects goes quadratically with the strain minus the critical strain divided the critical strain. Okay. So that's our attempt to study critical phenomena. And another...
what does it mean?
I don't know. So we are, but let me, so this is one of the attempts, another attempt. So what we are trying to understand is dislocation nucleation, right? So here what we show is when dislocations nucleate depending on the strain rate. So this is the strain. So this is each dot here is a dislocation that was nucleated in our sample. At the blue dots corresponds to low strain rates, green in intermediate, and red high strain rates. So this gives you kind of a map of strain and time, right? Sorry, of space and time, because imagine that the strain is your time, right? So when you have very high strain rates, they all nucleate at the same time, okay? And that's what you see. This is our different views of the nucleation events. When you have lower strain rates, they nucleate progressively, right? And what you can see is actually that they start in one plane, then in another plane, and then in this plane. So you can see that. When you go to very small strain rates, you see the same effect, that they start nucleating all in the same plane, then they start nucleating in another plane, then in another plane. Okay. So it's a kind of a time, space correlation. And so what we try to do here also is to, so we have flow stress at very high strain rates. So we want to expand this to lower strain rates. And what we did is using transition state theory, we can see the nucleation rate from the previous slide. We can get the nucleation rate. And using this nucleation rate, we can use the probability of the first nucleation can be written as this. And then we can take the average value at which the first nucleation happens. Is given by this formula, and this is this green curve. So using transition state theory, you can all the way from very high strain rates, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 5, all the way to experimental strain rates. So, so with this, those are the summaries that we discussed already. So what I want to do now is try to make connections to the things that Karen Damen did, right? So let's see if we can make some connections. So our dislocation evolution is based on this equation, basically, right? So we have a phase field, it's a Gibbs-Landau equation. So this is a interaction of dislocation, which is this non-local kernel. We have a stress, in this case, which is the driving force. And then here we have a pinning potential, which is obstacles, grain boundaries, so it's something that doesn't let the dislocations move. So there is some discussion now if this is true or not, but you can think of these dislocations as a model in which you have pin dislocations, and when you reach this critical strain or critical stress, the dislocation starts sliding. Okay? So it's this dislocation evolution is a pin-the-pin transition mechanism. So this takes you to avalanches and self-organized criticality. So what you see here is in magnetic systems, and this is the work of Karen. This is fracture. This is earthquakes. So what you see is the number of these events as a function of the size of these events follows a power law. Okay, so we did many years ago with these simulations of this system, and what you remember in the slow strain rate cases that we see all these jumps. So if you measure those, all these jumps are dislocations being nucleated and propagated. So we can have from our simulations we can have the amplitude of these events, which is proportional to the area that the dislocation flipped. And those are the events, right? So now what we can do is a plot of the number of events with certain size at an applied stress. And what we get is this. So these are the number of events and the size of events. If you plot from the previous slide, if you plot them like that, you get a power law that is 1.8 plus minus 0.1. So these are experiments, okay? And those experiments were done in ice. And so what they hear, what each event is an acoustic emission. So they measure the areas that the dislocation is lit by sound, basically. And so they have a very similar plot, and they have a, here they have a power law with an exponent 1.6. We get 1.8. But if you look at other experiments, they are between 1.8 and 2, basically. And so this is, I guess, the connection to, self-organized criticality. And then also what we look is at the distribution of cell structure. So when if you measure the size of the, so what you have here is basically regions that are dislocation free and regions that have a lot of dislocations. So this is a single crystal, copper, and inside one grain, dislocations rearrange in structures, in cellular structures. If you measure the fractal exponent of these cellular structures, what you get is this. So this is the cell distribution of, to get, so what you have is the number of cells. So this is the cell size and the number of cells that have a lambda greater than this cell size. Okay. And if you do this distribution, you have power loss again with an exponent that is close to here is in between 1.7 and 2. So we did the same with our structures in a single crystal. So this simulation now we don't have grain boundaries, it's just a single crystal. And what we get is that our cell size distribution also follows a power law and the exponent is 2.6. Okay? So here you have to take into account that we are doing the number of cell size with this size. In the previous slide was the number of cell size greater than a value, greater than certain value. So the exponent is, you have to subtract one to the exponent. So if we...
This may be interesting for reliability, right? The formation of these cells. I wonder whether the formation of these cells changes the, locks the material in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And maybe you can engineer the formation of the cells or whatever for long-term reliability. Because these locations provide hardening, right?
Yes.
So the generation of a structure that's very stable might lead to long-term behavior. If you cannot form these cells, maybe you have catastrophic failure, then the cells might prevent that. That may be interesting.
Hmm. Yeah.
The other part of it is that if you can separate reversible versus irreversible things, you kind of consider all of the energies. Can you calculate how much dissipation you have, how much through these processes?
We didn't do it, but we could. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could do that. Yeah. So I guess that's the connection that this is work that we have done 10 years ago. And another thing that you can see is that these structures, the fractal exponent of these structures, so the form of these structures depends on the applied stress. So as you increase the applied stress, the fractal exponent gets larger and here the same, right? So this is an experiment, this is our simulation. So if you apply more and more and more, so here is, we added a one, right? So to the, so remember I told you the experiments, they were 1.7, 1.8. Here I have to add one because of the way we count the cells, right? So they count cells greater than certain value or you count cells equal to certain value. So the fractal exponent, you have to add one. That's it. So that's what we see is that when you have very, very large stress, actually you have an exponent 3, which means that the whole sample, so you don't have a structure anymore. So if your exponent is 3, so you have cell structures when you have an exponent between 2 and 3. If you have a 3, means that it's not a structure anymore, that you have lines everywhere, basically.
I mean, all you mean about this fractal dimension is like almost surface to volume ratio internally, correct?
Basically, yeah. And all these are for single crystals. Okay, so if you look at this experiment, this is a 1 micron. Okay, so your grain should be larger, way larger than that. Otherwise, you don't see these structures. So I guess this is all for the dislocations, and now we also do faithful simulations of failure. So now I'm moving to a different direction. I don't think I have time to go into the details, but let me just give you an idea. So we have, so this, for example, this is PMMA. And if you load it, what the deformation, what happens in, during deformation is that you start having shear bands, right? So you start locally say, this is not crystal anymore. This is an amorphous polymer. So you have shear deformation concentrated in some planes. And this shear deformation progress into crazes that you see here. And what you see here is solid material, basically, solid material. And here you have fibers connecting the two. Okay, so when you break this, there are kind of like fibers, which is kind of what you see in this picture, right? So the fibers support the load. As you increase the stress, these fibers cut, right? And then you get, so you, actually you start this way. So you start with nano or micro voids that they start getting together, and then you have only fibers supporting your material. So what we do is a faithful again damage. So to model a crack, instead of separating the two materials, we have a field that tells you the material is broken here or is perfectly bonded and solid here. So this is one simple simulation. So you start with a crack in this direction, you load, and the crack propagates normal to the principal directions. So this is the whole model. So this model was developed by this some years ago, and now it's very widely used. So now, like in the last 4 years, I've seen many, many talks using this methodology to do cracks. So we have our, this is again, all the definitions of the parameters. Then we did simulations to adjust our parameters to some MD simulations. And we also did some comparison to experiments. But let me show you kind of the idea of how this evolves. So this is a fiber here. This is PMMA. We pull in this direction. So the cracks start forming and propagating in this direction. Here we assume that the bonding between the fiber and the polymer is perfect, so the crack forms away from the interface. Here we let the interface break, so there are like two, and you can do everything in between, right? So then you see how the crack gets into the interface and propagates in the other direction. Here are some simulations of crack. So again, we always load in the vertical direction. So the onset of the crack starts here and then evolves as you apply more and more load and starts propagating, and you see failure of the sample. This is another sample. And again, you have several cracks that start at the same point, but then some are more catastrophic than others, right? So this is very interesting because you can see branching of the crack. So this crack is the same one that starts here, starts propagating in this direction, then stops, and then starts moving in this direction. This one keeps going, and so on. So we can see all these structures. I think that's it. Then the other ones are details and comparison to experiments, and so to get these parameters in our model. So I think with this, I'll finish.